Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Tuesday, April the 23rd, and welcome to our commentary. We had to do a little rescheduling. We were going to chat today with our friend Leslie Eastman of Legal Insurrection, but unfortunately, we had some mistakes, some problems in the technology, and, you know, sometimes the technology wins, and in this case, we rescheduled Leslie for another day this week on Friday. So I was looking forward to that because she writes some really good posts over at Legal Insurrection and always enjoy getting her California perspective on many of the issues that affect the nation, like illegal immigration and her wonderful coverage of the climate change issue. So we're going to have to do it on Friday, and let's hope that all the machines are working on Friday and so on. But we had to reschedule. And that's a shame because I always enjoy chatting with Leslie of Legal Insurrection. Well, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the country. And let's begin with the college, the situation in the colleges. Look, I don't know how to explain it, but this is, to me, the basic problem here. We have a perfect storm in what's happening in the universities. You have this, you know, attitude in the universities, which is, I think, very much anti-American, very much anti-West. And a lot of that has created this mentality among so many of these young people that the world is divided between oppressors and victims. And of course, the oppressors are the United States and Israel, the countries that they perceive as being white dominated. And the oppressors, of course, are people of color. So when they look at the situation between Israel and Hamas, well, they see it as, you know, that challenge between the white oppressors and the victims of color. Now, that's a very simplistic way of looking at Israel, but that's how they look at it because that's what they're being taught in the universities. So that's the first problem of the perfect storm, what these students are being taught at many of these universities. You know, I see these white women marching, many young white women marching, and I ask myself, do these people even know what would happen if we were actually operating under the system that they claim, you know, that Hamas or whatever system they claim to be, you know, they want us to be living under, or they're accusing Israel of destroying. They don't have a clue. They don't understand anything. They're just, again, seeing everything in terms of victims and oppressors. And that's why you have this this problem. So that's your first component here. This oppressor versus victim mentality that is poisoning our universities. It's just completely poisoning them. And that's what you're seeing. And I guess you're also seeing it at NYU and in other of these so-called elite colleges. So that's the first thing. The second issue here is a lack of moral clarity from the administrators in these colleges. And they've created a situation where you can say anything and do anything and protest against anything because you have a right to protest. Well, sure, you have a right to protest. You do not have a right to shut down bridges, to shut down streets, to block the school or not allowing, for example, a Jewish teacher to go into the school. You don't have the right to do that. You don't have the right to interfere with the education of thousands of students who want to go to class this day. You don't have a right to do that. You don't have the right to force the school to put classes online because you've got some political beef that you want to protest about. So again, this breakdown in order, what we're teaching in the schools, all of this has created this perfect storm. And we're seeing it in front of Columbia University. You're seeing it in other colleges. And really, I'm glad to see that this gentleman, Mr. Kraft, who owns the New England Patriots, I'm glad to see that he's talking about this and he's going to hold back some money. I'm glad to see that. I'm glad to see that because that is a part of the solution. Where the alumni, when the people who go to these schools start saying, you know what, we're not going to pay you another dime. That's what happened with Harvard and with Yale, where many people said, we're not going to give you another dime as long as you keep tolerating this kind of anti-Semitic behavior. So I'm glad to see that. I'm glad to see that that's happening. But the bottom line here is that the administrators are going to have to take back the schools from these rowdy students. They're going to have to say, no, you do not have the right to protest and keep other students from going to school. You do not have a right to block the streets and block bridges, as we have seen across the country. So really, the administrators are the ones who have to take this back and say, we're the administrators, you're the students, and these are the rules that you have to play by. If you don't like the rules, hey, you don't have to come to this school. That's the kind of attitude that has to prevail in many of these administrators. But I'm sad to tell you that the administrators and the teachers are often the same people. They're coming from the same woke mentality that believes that the world, everything in history, is a battle between the oppressor and the victim. That's the attitude they have. And that's why, unfortunately, we are in the mess that that we are in. Now, I also think that, and this is where President Biden has to step in into this debate. I've got a post coming out tomorrow. I have a post coming out tomorrow about comparing President Biden with President Clinton. If you remember back in 1992, President Clinton confronted I think she was a singer. I'm not sure, remember her name, but Sister Souljah, I think it was, that was her name. And she made a racist remark that was absolutely horrible. And then candidate Bill Clinton confronted her and said, no, you don't do that. You don't speak that way. And I'm not, you know, tolerating that. And I'm not associating myself with people who do that. And as a consequence, I think Clinton not only gained a lot of respect for doing something like that, but I think politically it worked well for him. Well, President Biden's going to have to do something similar, but can he do it? Can he do it? And that's the point of my article coming out Wednesday morning, because I think the Democrat Party that Bill Clinton was in 1992 would allow for a presidential candidate to say what Bill Clinton said back in 1992. But I don't think the current Democrat Party would allow President Biden to say that, because he doesn't have the courage to confront many of the radical elements in Michigan, in Minnesota, in his own congressional caucus. I mean, you've got people in the congressional caucus who are more radical than some of these kids who are marching. And he doesn't have the courage to confront any of those people. You know, the White House issued a statement saying that, they condemn anti-Semitic thing, but it was not the president who read it, or the statement was not, you know, prepared for the president. It was just a White House statement let me say hello to my friend Super Pilot joining in. And the White House issued that statement, but it was a very vanilla statement. I mean, it was kind of an obvious statement. But the one who should have gone before the cameras, either on a national speech or at the press room, should have been the president of the United States. He should have been the one who to come out and say, this is wrong. I don't stand with this. And if you support these kinds of activities, if you're out in the streets saying, you know, I am Hamas, and if you're out in the streets saying anything about October 7th, I'm not with you. You're not with me. I don't want you in our party. If you're out there saying stuff like that, that's the kind of courage that you need, that sends out a very clear message of where you stand. But President Biden wants to have it on both sides. He wants to be on both sides of this. He wants to, you know, obviously, he wants to say something on behalf of Israel, but he doesn't want to lose 100,000 votes in Michigan. If you remember during the primary, this Congresswoman, Rashida Tlaib, basically told the voters, the Democrat voters in Michigan, vote uncommitted, because she's not happy with President Biden's policy in Israel. So she said, vote uncommitted. 100,000 then of them did. 14% of the vote in the Democrat primary was uncommitted, meaning they're not voting for Biden. I'm not sure who they're going to vote for, but they didn't want to vote for Biden. Now, Biden won Michigan by a lot less than 100,000. I don't have the number, but it was significantly less than 100,000. You go to Minnesota, okay, this other congresswoman in Minnesota who's very radical too. There are parts of Minneapolis, there are districts in Minnesota where the same thing is happening. And Biden is trying to have it both ways. He wants to take care of Israel on one hand, but on the other hand, he doesn't want to upset, if you will, segments of his party who are very much anti-Israel and who are behind all of these attacks. And that's his problem. But you know what? When you're the president of the United States, sometimes you have to choose. And sometimes you have to come out and say, you know what? If you're marching in those streets, and if you believe in what these people are marching for, I don't want you. We don't want you in the Democrat Party if you believe that it's okay to kill 15-year-old girls and to rape them in a music festival. If you believe that, we don't want you in our party. So we don't have a president, unfortunately, we don't, who has that kind of moral clarity. And that moral clarity is essential, in my opinion, right now, because this is an issue that is more than just a typical political issue. There are two sides here, and there's a good side and a bad side. Okay, there's a good guy and there's a bad guy. And the president of the United States has to make it very clear that we stand with Israel. But more than that, we do not support people who go into a music festival in Israel and kill hundreds of young people who are having fun at a concert and then go house by house and kill a bunch of families who are having breakfast. We don't support that. We are against that. And that's the kind of clarity that we're not getting from the president of the United States. And until we do, we're going to have this kind of confusion in the country. By the way, speaking of post, I have a post over at the American Thinker today. And by the way, you can also check my American Thinker post over at Twitter. I post them over at Twitter every morning. But I have one this today talking about young people and how young people are accepting Trump a lot more than they did in 2020. You know, the difference in the vote between Trump and Biden this year with young people is a lot closer. And a lot of it has to do with the economy. A lot of young people are realizing that their future, whether it's buying a home or getting a job or just enjoying life and not having to pay all this inflation, that their future is not as bright right now. And many of those young people are reconsidering Trump. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Because I think that, you know, I believe that Trump is a better choice than Biden in 2024. And I'm glad to see that other people, including young people who are so Democrat, are considering the same thing. Let me leave you with a little note from on this day in history. 1954, so that makes it 70 years ago today, a fellow by the name of Henry Aaron hit his first home run. Now, the trivia question is, who was the pitcher? Well, the pitcher was Vic Rocchi of the St. Louis Cardinals. At the time, Henry Aaron was playing for the Milwaukee Braves, and he hit number one. Of course, who knew in 1954 that this would be number one of 755? But it began today, one afternoon game in St. Louis, when Henry Aaron hit number one. Henry Aaron, who, by the way, one little trivia thing about Henry Aaron that you may want to keep in mind. Henry Aaron was the last player from the Negro Leagues to make it to the majors. He was the last player of the Negro Leagues to make it to the major. The Negro Leagues, of course, existed in the 40s and 30s. And those were the so-called Negro Leagues, where the black players would play. And of course, in the majors, the white players would play. But it was actually a very good league. You know, there were some great players in the Negro Leagues. And Henry Aaron was the last graduate of the Negro Leagues to play in the majors. And he hit number one on this day in 1954. Thank you for listening. Everybody have a good day. We're going to reschedule, as I mentioned at the beginning, we're going to reschedule Leslie Eastman from Legal Insurrection. We're going to have her back on Friday. And hopefully the machines will work on Friday and we can do our interview with, as always. Thank you for your comments, Super. And we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.